Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots. Hello, listeners. Tate Duryea here with Ryan Gibson. What's up, my man?
What's going on? It's fun to be in Seattle with you, enjoying the nice, beautiful weather. We just had a nice lunch and planning session about Passive Income Pilots and the future of where we're going. And we're excited to plan out our show for our listeners. And really excited to talk today about the economy, where we're headed, what's going on. Unemployment seems to be relatively low, but also increasing with the jobs report not being as strong last time. But also retail sentiment is kind of strong. People are out buying and shopping, and real estate is headed in the right direction right now with interest rates being reduced potentially at the September Fed meeting. And so I'm really interested to hear from an economist, somebody who's actually been an analyst in real estate and actually a PhD at University of Denver in the real estate realm, and somebody who's been studying markets for over 40 years. And so what a better person to bring onto the show. So if you don't know anything about REITs, we're going to give you a crash course on that. And Dr. Miller is. And also we're going to talk about the economy at the very end and kind of where we are and what we can expect. But I think my favorite part about this episode was he actually broke down how to analyze whether or not a REIT stock is a good buy or not. And I had absolutely no idea how to do that until the show. And he made it so simple to understand. So I'm excited about what we're talking about. But Tate, tell us a little more about Dr. Glenn Miller and his pedigree and his background.
Yeah, actually, I mentioned on the show, but I saw Dr. Glenn Miller at a keynote at a conference many years back. He's absolutely incredible wealth of knowledge. He's a PhD. He's got 48 years of real estate industry experience, including 41 years of research, over 100 published articles in areas of real estate market cycle analysis, real estate securities analysis, or REITs, public and private market investment strategies, real estate capital market portfolio investment diversification analysis. The guy is a wizard, and he's a professor at University of Denver. It was an amazing conversation, so I'm excited to get into it.
Yeah, I loved at the very end of the show, he actually revealed all of the go-to sources of information that he reads daily. So we're going to share that at the end of what is a professional economist in real estate actually reading every day to be informed. And so he's going to break all that down at the end of the show. So hope you stick around and listen to that. But with that, let's get to the show.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. You are unbelievably astute economist, real estate professor. We just really want to get your take on the state of the economy, the state of the real estate industry, and anything that's on your mind lately when you're teaching class or out there investing yourself.
Sure. Growing up as a kid in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, being around planes and actually grew up on Lake Winnebago. We used to go out in the boat and watch the air show from there on the water. I have spent my entire career in real estate, and it's done very well for me. I know that, and I have many pilot friends from that standpoint, that one of the easy things to be able to do is buy houses, fix them up, flip them, that type of thing. I got into real estate by chance with a degree in finance, and then an MBA, and worked as a loan analyst at a bank where I got put into the real estate department, and then went out and was a builder and developer myself. I've now built 58 housing units, I'm going to call them, in my lifetime, mostly custom single family homes, but also some condominiums. And then went back to school, got my PhD in real estate at Georgia State University, got a job teaching at the University of Denver. 4 years in, got hired away by Prudential Real Estate Investors to help institutions invest in real estate. And our biggest client was CalPERS, California Public Employees Retirement System, which is the largest public pension plan in the United States. They're, I think, close to $500 billion now, with about a 15% allocation to real estate, or $45 billion in real estate. So they own properties all over the country and all the major property types and stuff like that. So I look at real estate as two areas. One is home ownership, and the other is, I'm going to use a new term here for you, income producing real estate. And the reason I do that is, if I say the term residential, everybody goes, oh, you mean like apartments and houses? And I go, no, apartments are income producing, houses are owned and used. Yes, you can rent your house out too, and then it flips over to becoming income producing. But most people own a home. I'm sure most pilots own a home, and it's a use asset just like their car. And it's costly. You typically finance it. You got to maintain it. You got to feed it with gas or electricity or both and that type of thing. And you use it. And if you are to sell it because it went up in value and you want something of equal utility, say good location, that kind of stuff, it's probably going to cost you the same amount. So even though a lot of people see a lot of house price appreciation and they're sitting on that, they can access it by increasing their mortgage. But if they sell it and want to buy something else, if it's as nice as what they had, it's going to cost them pretty much the same amount. So put that off to the side and let's talk about income producing real estate. The two ways to invest are obviously buying and owning direct real estate yourself, going into private real estate limited partnerships that are out there, or investing in publicly traded REITs. And I have worked on both sides of that coin as well. I worked for a brokerage group called Legg Mason for over a decade and helped take 22 real estate companies public as publicly traded REITs. So the REIT world today, they are over $1 trillion in value in the US, and about 30 other countries also have the whole REIT concept in their countries. So in liquid form, obviously you can sell and buy the stocks every day. So there's big picture. And what I do is I produce a real estate market cycle report where I cover the five major property types: office, industrial, retail, multifamily, and hotel, and where they are in the cycle, i.e., are their occupancies moving up, which means their income's moving up. If occupancies move up, rents move up. If occupancies come down, rents come down. And that is the income side of real estate. And then the price side is based on capital flows. If a lot of capital is flowing into real estate, prices go up, just like if more flows into the stock market.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is incredible. I love this. Can I zoom out? And I've got a curious question. Ryan and I are big real estate guys. We try not to be too biased on this show. We try to bring on, you know, a wide variety of guests that are in different sectors. But why real estate? Why did you get a PhD in real estate? What's so special about it for you, in your own words?
Well, first of all, it's a tangible asset that you can hold and feel. I'm good with my hands, and you know, being a builder was part of that. The creativity of looking at something and figuring out what it could be is a lot of fun. Taking, as a matter of fact, I've got two houses. I'm in my summer home right now. You're in Minnesota near my grandkids on a nice lake, and bought a house that was built in the 70s that was, you know, old, heavy, dark wood with small windows and all that kind of, and just opened the place up and made it into something that is really nice. And it's a use asset for me. So that part was good. And I'm also really good with numbers, and the financial side of real estate is, you know, easy to follow and understand. A lot of times you see the stock market and you go, why did it do that? And the answer is, to me, the stock market is emotional in the short term, but logical over the long run. So if you see that I've got a company that has great fundamentals and everything else, but there's some bad news, and eventually that bad news will be gone, you know, it potentially, you know, the value will come back, you know, just like buying a house and, you know, waiting for things to turn around. So, you know, or fix it up to then resell it to somebody else for a higher price. So, you know, on the income producing side, those five property types move somewhat differently in their cycles. As we all know, office is hurting right now because of the work from home kind of thing. And therefore, occupancies have come down, rents have come down, values have come down. But the general media, the news, they always come up with, oh, you know, Armageddon kind of stuff. And they paint, you know, the headline is real estate's crashing. Then when you read the article, it goes, well, it's really just office, right? Industrial has done, warehouse space has done unbelievably well because of the Amazon effect and more people buying things online. I just got a package today. The demand there has been outstanding for over a decade. Little bit of overbuilding happened in the last year or so, and things slowed down a little bit for Amazon, but it's not going away. It's coming back. Apartments, high demand for apartments. As a matter of fact, a great, great fun factoid here is that we are 6.5 million housing units short in this country. And that's either homeownership or rental, right? And you say, but we've got some markets like, for instance, Denver is a little bit overbuilt in the new Class A downtown office space. But we are sorely lacking affordable housing, less expensive housing, you know, if I can say B and C class, but lower priced apartments and that type of thing. The demand is huge and it's not going away. Interest rates went up, making housing more less affordable, making building new apartments less profitable. And so we slowed down supply, even though demand continues to rise. Go to retail, and retail was hurting a decade ago because of the Amazon effect. That slowed down new supply. Today, retail is actually doing unbelievably well. Highest occupancy I've ever seen in the 40 years I've got data on, and rents moving up, demand there. 80% of all new retail being built is pre-leased. In other words, someone says, I need this, build it for me. I'll sign a lease now, right? And then hotels, the hardest of them because it's rented on a daily basis. Obviously, huge crash when COVID hit and has bounced back and is very strong. But we have to break that down too into the fact that downtown business hotels where people come in to stay to go to your office the next day, that's still not doing well. But resort off the charts, right? And highway hotels, et cetera, doing extremely well. So it's you have to kind of break it down and look at it. We can't just paint this with one broad brush, right? So like, go ahead.
No, I love that. I'm fascinated with the urban real estate futures, which there's no more office, right? Like people aren't going downtown to use the office. So, you know, I'm in Seattle right now. Actually, Tate's here in Seattle with me today. And I'm in an office building that is, I'm the last tenant in the building. And I'm moving to a new office space that I've negotiated very well, right next door, newer office building, more amenities. And that office only has one tenant, which is the building owner. And, you know, I see these cities just kind of circling the drain from the standpoint of nobody's going back to the office. So if nobody goes back downtown, then they don't go to coffee shops. They don't go to sandwich shops. So then they go out of business. And then you were just mentioning, you know, there's no need to rent that hotel downtown. And I mean, how do you feel about the future of that? Or what are you kind of seeing? I mean, is that just an endless spiral of death of cities, or are you seeing that coming back? What's your thoughts there?
So believe it or not, in the rest of the world, office has done okay and it has come back. And more companies are finding that, you know, working at home, some is fine, but working at home all the time doesn't work. But what they need is potentially therefore less space. Okay. So, and right now, again, if we break office down, premium class A, brand new stuff built in the last 5 years, et cetera, has over a 95% occupancy level to it, and they're raising rents. So, you know, companies that want to impress people with office space are doing that. Also, some good quality suburban office space is doing well, but the B and C class space is what's really, really hurting at this point in time. Just was at a conference, and a national architectural firm that's been helping a lot of companies look at the potential of converting office into apartments and that kind of thing. Came back and said, we've now run an analysis, and in most cities, about 30% of office space could be converted to that. The rest of it, you know, for whatever reason, floor plates of the building, location, other things make that not economically justifiable. Demand for office is growing. Office using employment is up 1% last year, but we are also in the process of just completing a lot of new downtown office space. To build a new office building downtown in any city, major city in the country, is about an 8-year process. So we've got new space coming online that was started 8 years ago. That dies off about a year from now. So supply will go to almost nothing and the other stuff will be built back up. And of course, buildings are selling for 20 to 40 cents on the dollar at some point because investors are saying, hey, it's worth less than my mortgage, and hand it back to the bank. Okay. So it's a longer down cycle than you'd normally assume, and it's not going to be dead. A lot of millennials still want to live downtown, and you know, we'll see where that goes.
Do you think there's an opportunity in office? You know, we as real estate investors, you're always trying to stay ahead of the curve. This seemed to be more of a fundamental shift in the way that people lived and worked. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that, you know, I know that you have to be very careful with what sort of office product you get into right now, but is there an opportunity to go buy something for 20 to 40 cents on a dollar and make a killing inside of 5 years, or is it just too much risk?
Oh, no. If you find a building that you could convert to multifamily, in some cases they're now even doing some conversion to warehouse and that type of thing, or even convert to some retail, you know, convert to something else for their immediately demand, yes, sure. But again, as you say, it takes a lot of research and thought and creativity to make sure you're doing it right.
What are your thoughts on co-working spaces? I know my wife and I during COVID were, there was a new co-working space going in across the street. We were licking the windows, you know, as they were building it out because we're so sick of working from our living room. Have you seen co-working spaces really flourish, or is it just so micro that it's on a deal by deal basis that that you can't really forecast it out on a broad paintbrush?
Yeah, no, it's totally a deal by deal basis and a city by city basis and a submarket by submarket basis too.
That's what we love about real estate, is it's so niche, it's so micro that you can have such an unfair advantage in it. You know, insider trading is illegal in the stock market, but it's completely legal and encouraged in real estate. You can profit off of things that only you know and other people don't.
I just think this is so fascinating because, I mean, I've just seen it in Seattle. You know, just the economic vibrance of this city and this region is really strong, but there's so much office vacancy here and prices, like you said, have gone down so much. And I'm personally experiencing the negotiating power as I end a lease in the current office space that I'm in that I was considered probably a C-plus building, and go to an A building, and I'm experiencing exactly what you said, and which is really just kind of a flight to quality. Dr. Miller, like, what opportunities do you see that may not be so obvious to everybody else right now? I mean, if you're sitting on cash on the sidelines, you know, what would be your kind of bet over the next 5 years?
Well, believe it or not, I think rental housing is a good place to be. While housing values went up, they've come down a little bit. And remember, people go, when I was a builder, people would come to me and say, hey, I'm going to wait till interest rates come down before I buy. I said, when they do, what I'm selling for is going to go up in price, right? Because you know, if you can afford to buy it today, buy it. And when interest rates come down, refinance at a lower rate and your monthly payment goes down. And anybody who can pencil out a deal today in apartments or single family for rent, those I think potentially work very, very well. In the, if you will, I'll skip over to the other ones for individual investors. Getting into an industrial or retail or anything else are somewhat tough. So let me jump over to the publicly traded world and that of REITs. And REIT stocks will trade either at, we have something we call NAV or net asset value. In other words, if I took a company today, took all its real estate, sold it off in the private market and paid stockholders out, we call that net asset, you know, buy the share. So, and the big story back in 2008 was that a guy who had got things going big time in the publicly traded real estate world started an office REIT, and it was his name is Sam Zell. Sam Zell had Equity Office, and it was trading at $44 a share. He had Black come in and offer him $52 a share. Other people are at it bid up to $59 a share, right? BlackRock bought it. They had most of the properties already sold to pension funds and endowments, and they kept the final, it was a $59 billion transaction. They kept the final $3 billion worth of properties to start their own real estate fund, right? So it was trading at 49, you know, but the NAV, the private market sale value was 50, it was 44, and it sold at 59. That's like a 25% difference. If we go by property type today, you know, offices trading at a discount to NAV, retail's trading at an equal value, industrial's trading at equal value, apartments are, hotels are trading a little bit of a premium today. In other words, they're above or below. So you can play that game of, are we above or below net asset value? Here's a particular sector I should be in now and move out of, you know, down, you know, when it moves up. Once we're 10 or 20% over NAV, we're out. When we're 20% below, we're in.
What are some REIT tickers? This is great. What are some REIT tickers that somebody can go look at, or where does somebody go to find some good REITs in those sectors?
Well, with 182 of them, you know, I actually, the best thing to do is, little plug here, buy my textbook, Educated REIT Investing. It's very short and easy. It's on Amazon for $29. And it takes you through the steps to how to analyze a company and make those selections. Pick a property sector you think is going to do well. Go in and look at all the companies, analyze their stock earnings multiple, and pick them and go, if you have one goes, my God, this one's really, you know, really looks like a great deal. You go in and find out, well, they got a problem. They got too much debt, or they got something going on, or the CEO just died and there's no captain at the head of the ship kind of thing. So it's a really, and I, you know, I teach a class too.
We'll link to it in the show notes.
Yeah. Yeah. What great value there. You know, you say discount to the NAV, and I'm sure your book has probably like a multiple chapters on it. How do you know that they're discounted to the NAV? I mean, just in maybe like a quick summary, what?
Sure. So I take the, we use what's called a cap rate, you know, cash on cash return, like a bond yield, right? So I take and I say, okay, what's every REIT has to report? It's totally open. All the income coming off their properties, less their expenses, not the expenses of being a public company, like paying the CEO and, you know, 10 Ks, 10 Qs, but you've got the rent coming off the property, less the property operating costs. You take that and that gives you a cash flow. You divide it by the private market cap rate, okay, which you can find, call any broker and they'll go to CoStar or somebody and say, hey, the cap rate on suburban office right now is 6.2%. You cap that income and it says it's got X in value. It's got, you know, it's got $1 billion worth of private direct real estate. Take that, add in any cash it's sitting on, subtract out all its debt. Say here, if we sold it and liquidated today, we'd have X amount of money, $800 million, and there's 80 million shares, so it's worth $10 a share, and it's trading at 5.
There you go.
It's a fairly simple process. It's a fairly simple math process.
And I'm going to make a little plug for commercial real estate here, because we've talked about this on the show. And for anybody that's still kind of catching up, what Dr. Miller's talking about is NOI, net operating income, right? And net operating income, so it's the income minus the expenses on the property in cash, right? So we don't consider debt service, but it's all the expenses except for the debt service, gives you net operating income. You divide that through cap rate and it gives you valuation. That's why we love commercial real estate, is because it's controllable. You can't control the cap rate that fluctuates with the market, but you can control your NOI. You can increase income, reduce expenses on a property, and you tangibly affect the value of that real estate. That's why we love it so much.
Absolutely. Dr. Miller, can you take a step back? I really appreciate your NAV, net asset value description, because I don't know if anybody's ever explained it that clearly to me before, but can you kind of just talk about what makes a REIT and kind of what is a REIT versus just being in real estate? Because I think Tate and I get a lot of questions about, oh, is Spartan a REIT? Is Turbine a REIT?
Right.
And we're just syndicating equity for a limited partnership, and by virtue getting direct ownership through the LP interest, right? They're not really on the title, but how is that different from a REIT? And, you know, kind of walk us through just a little bit of an overview on that.
Okay, great. The easiest way to think about a REIT is nothing more than a mutual fund. Okay. What is a mutual fund? A mutual fund takes a bunch of investors, pools their money together under professional management, and that professional management makes investments, and I'm going to use the stock market at the moment, with some strategy: large cap stocks, small cap stocks, value stocks, growth stocks, okay? REITs take a bunch of investors, pool their money together with a strategy of investing in most often one property type, office, industrial, retail, and even in many cases, like in retail, we only do malls. We only do grocery anchored shopping centers. We only do a standalone triple net lease, you know, McDonald's, Burger King's, that kind of thing. Okay. So what you're getting is a professional management handling that kind of stuff, right? And by the way, when I say publicly traded REITs, I'm talking about ones that are traded on the stock market. There are many non-traded, and I didn't use the word private here, there are many non-traded REITs where they don't trade on the marketplace, but they still use the REIT structure. Same kind of thing, right? And so in other words, you're doing the same thing. You're taking investors' money, pooling it together. You're just using the limited partnership vehicle versus the REIT vehicle. The major difference is that the REIT vehicle doesn't pass through the tax savings of depreciation and all that kind of. So in other words, you're giving your investors income every year, and a lot of that is sheltered by the depreciation because they're a partner in it as opposed to a shareholder in stock. That's really the only difference. Okay. So, and you could take what you're doing and turn it into a REIT. And as a matter of fact, many of the REITs today were small, you know, partnership syndicators like yourselves who got large enough to say, hey, we want to go public. Better access to capital. Think about this. You have two access to capital, the private equity you bring in or loans from a bank, right? And I'm going to call that private debt. Okay. REITs can do that too, because they can say, hey, right now my stock price is low, but I got this great buy. I can go out and sell a participating interest in one of my properties to a private investor. Or as a matter of fact, CalPERS might say, hey, I'll buy half an interest in your, you know, $300 million mall for $150 million, give you the cash. Now I'm a half owner. You still operate it for me and that kind of thing. They just raise money in the private marketplace. If their stock price is high as above their NAV, they're going to sell more shares and use that to buy properties. REITs can do one other thing that is fantastic. They can issue corporate debt. So they get a bond rating, just like any other publicly traded company. And they can, and they go out and say, hey, we're gonna put out a $500 million bond offering for people to buy at the rate of X. And by the way, that rate is typically slightly below what it might cost you directly for a mortgage. And I'm going to take a bunch of properties. I'm going to take $1 billion worth of properties and put them up as collateral for that bond pool. So it's like we're really doing a 50% loan to value loan here, right? The really cool thing about being a REIT is that they have the right of substitution. If you own a property that you have a mortgage on in the commercial space, most of the time you have to pay, if the bank says you can't, you have a yield maintenance clause that says you must, you know, you got a 10-year mortgage, you can't pay it off early, right? Or if you do, you're going to have to pay us, you know, an interest rate, you know, the difference in interest that we would have received, that kind of thing, right? The REIT can say, I'm taking property 42 out of my pool because I'm selling it and I'm bringing a brand new property in to substitute it. So they can move properties easily. The other thing that publicly traded REITs have is they have a line of credit from a bank. So a $1 billion REIT would normally have at least $100 million line of credit, which is honestly just like a credit card, right? And when they walk in to buy a property, they go, we're a cash buyer. We can close tomorrow, period, paragraph. No other questions asked. After they buy it, then they decide, okay, are we going to issue some more shares of stock to pay for this? Or are we going to, you know, sell some more bonds or put a mortgage on the property? Could be they've got four options of getting money versus private only has two. That's the real value in being a publicly traded REIT. So, and they're big companies. Now there's 50 of them. They're over $1 billion in size. Okay. And they are hands down the best property managers on the planet Earth.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, just in our business, we actually have hired REITs to property manage our companies, some of our storage businesses. So we do mostly on our own, but we've actually hired publicly traded REITs. They actually do third-party property management for a lot of businesses. My question, sorry, we're going deep on REITs. I you know, you've got so much knowledge in it. It's kind of fun to talk to you about it. What gives a signaling to the market that a REIT is on a buying spree? Like right now, I've heard a lot of the self-storage REITs are sort of pencils down and they're not buying a lot right now because maybe their stock price is down. How does that interplay? How do I know that's, you know,
Whenever my stock price is above my NAV, I'm selling shares and buying more properties. Anytime my stock price is below NAV, I'm not. As a matter of fact, I may even buy back shares instead of buying a property, right? Because that improves my earnings per share. Decrease the number of shares with the same, you know, with the same, because I'm sitting on some cash, and right now the prices are up everywhere. And the reason for that is that the self-storage REITs were doing unbelievably well, you know, during COVID and after COVID, because people needed places to store their stuff because they were living in more at home, needed more space, and that leasing trajectory has flattened out, and therefore, if my occupancy is not going up, I can't raise my rents as fast, and therefore my earnings aren't going up. As soon as your earnings forecast doesn't look good, what do? Your stock price goes up. People say, I don't want this stock anymore. I want to find a different stock. So they have to deal with the emotions of the market, who are looking forward and guessing at what's going on. If the market's wrong and they come back stronger, the stock price will bounce back up, right?
Yep. Yeah, without getting any tax, legal, or investment advice, check out the storage REITs. It might be a buying opportunity. Do your own due diligence and make your own decisions. But no, I think that's really fascinating. So talk about the speculation. I mean, it's just subject to any speculation that you would otherwise have in a stock. Maybe that could be a downside to the REIT. I mean, the REIT may not necessarily, my understanding is it may not perform. You know, if my property performs in a limited partnership, it doesn't care what the emotion is. It cares what the income is. It sounds like a REIT is a little bit more speculation of what they think the company might do at some future point. Is that right?
Yes. In other words, fun story. When we would take companies public, what you'd have is, you know, a wealthy real estate baron in a city, and I'll give an example, working with a guy, $100 million worth of office space in Atlanta back in 1998. And, said, hey, I'm doing well and everything else, but I'm thinking about retiring. And, you know, if I become a public company, then, my wealth is liquid and all that kind of stuff. And say, okay, yeah. And, how much you're making? Well, I don't want to talk about that. You're a public company that, you know, you're going to be paid, right? And how many shares do you own? I don't want to tell people that. Well, that's required in a public, in a public thing. So what we used to say to people is, are you ready to strip naked, get on a treadmill in a fishbowl and run for the rest of your life? Because anybody, any analyst can ask them a question, any investor can ask them a question. And if they don't answer, you say, then I'm selling your stock and your share price is going to drop. So it's a different life. And many of those real estate barons after a while said, boy, this is not fun. And therefore they hired someone else to then become the CEO of their company and just became chairman of the board because they own so much stock.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Makes sense.
What are you buying right now in REITs?
So, REITs have come up in value here over the last couple of months. They had a bad time. As soon as interest rates went up, they go, real estate can't do well when interest rates are up. They have bounced down. They've started to come back. The projection that interest rates are going to come down has what's been making them start to move up. Whereas in the private market, a lot of cases, the prices haven't started coming back yet because we actually have to have a transaction with a lower mortgage rate to make that go. So the REITs are moving ahead, if you will, from that standpoint, and could they move further ahead? In my time as a analyst, covering companies and doing all that kind of stuff, I had to request to be able to buy a stock 30 days before I could buy it, and then hold it for at least 6 months, and then request to sell it and wait 30 days to sell it. So doing individual stocks didn't work really well for me, but I could buy into a mutual fund. So I use Vanguard's, REIT mutual fund, and it swings up and down. And I have, I had a year where I literally would watch it go up and down 10% at a time, and I would play in and out of that, and I made $300,000 one. So
it's amazing.
If REITs are subject to speculation and not tax beneficial, why would one want to buy a REIT stock versus just a blue chip stock or a Facebook or something?
Historically, over the last 30 years, REITs have averaged over a 12% return versus the stock market at 8.5%.
Wow.
Right. Wow. And REITs have, REITs, about 50%, 40 to 50% of their term is income versus appreciation. So what I say is real estate really has REITs have bond-like income, just like direct real estate does, with not quite stock-like appreciation. But when you combine the two together, it's as good or better. So best place to put REITs is in your retirement account because you're not paying taxes on the income coming in. And, that's a great place to set it because it's so hard to take your retirement account and do direct investments. right?
Right.
Buy properties and do that kind of stuff. But that's where I have my big holdings and rates are in my retirement accounts.
What's there you go for your 401k?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Get the Roth going and REIT stock. Yeah, that's great. Is there like some kind of a blended REIT fund that kind of maybe aggregates a multitude of different retail stores?
What's right. that? So again, Vanguard's fund, and I use an ETF versus the mutual fund. Its stock symbol is VNQ. Okay. And after COVID hit, as soon as they started talking about interest rates going up, I knew REIT stocks were going to drop. I sold out of VNQ at 111 at the stock price. Okay. It dropped to 77. I got in at 76 and at 80. And today it closed at 90 something. And then I think you can watch it on it. Closed at 91.38. So
there you go.
Right. And, earning great income, growing my retirement portfolio.
So I want to ask, is that a good price for someone to get in if they're just getting in? But what I want to contextualize that with is to shift the conversation to market cycles, and maybe pepper in some broader economics as well. Because, one thing that I've been dying to have on this show for the last 6 months is to have somebody who really is astute in economics tell us what the heck is going on. We've had a lot of things sort of come out of left field and hit us in the last 4 years. We had COVID, which nobody saw coming, of course. And then, in June of 2021, the Fed said they will hold interest rates near zero, sees two rate hikes in 2023. We all knew what happened. Know what happened at the end of that year, which is they went on the fastest rate hiking cycle in history. I don't know if you saw that coming, but I mean, from what I've heard, even BlackRock and Goldman didn't see that coming based on what the Fed was saying and then what happened. Where are we now? Where are we in this cycle? There's so many market indicators that are pointing crisscrossed. Where do you see us in the general economy and then maybe niche down on the different types of real estate asset classes?
Right.
So for me, real estate is totally driven by employment growth, and employment growth continues to be positive. Don't see it going negative. We've got too low an unemployment rate to make that happen. So I think the economy continues to chug along. I'm sort of in favor of the Austrian economics approach, which is government.
Absolutely.
Leave things alone and they'll work out, right? When the Fed tampers, it just amplifies the ups and downs. So with that in mind, in many cases, the Fed it's like the Fed putting on the brakes, and we're slowing down. We haven't come to a complete stop, right? But so they should start letting off and let the economy roll along. Instead, they keep pushing until we actually come to a stop and have a recession before letting off. It appears that this time they're probably going to start letting off before we actually go into a recession. So I'm a positive on that's going to look okay and pick up and move forward. Slow economic growth is for me a good thing in real estate because, demand continues to grow. With these higher interest rates, we have slowed the supply of all new property types because it's more expensive now, even though we need it, which will, I think, force housing prices, both rental and ownership, higher over time because of the demand's there, period, paragraph.
Right.
Okay. And what happens with the rest of the world affects us as well. China, I think, has a real problem. Their one child over the last few decades is now coming back to bite them. Kind of like they're going to be like Japan, has been. That they're slowing, therefore affects us and our slowing as well. So I don't know any economist that ever gets it right. Right.
Of course.
And the majority, what I guess I care about is the direction. Is the direction up or down? How fast or how slow is impossible to know. So
right.
I think the direction is up and a very slow up.
Absolutely. I concur with your crystal ball. Mine's broken as well. I think everyone's is. But you know, I think sometimes people look at the stock market, they look at the S&P and they say, well, you know, when's the crash coming? Because it's just gone up and to the right for so long. I think you also have to look at currency devaluation, right? That some of those gains are just a natural function of the inflation that occurred. So we're almost crashing up rather than crashing down, if that makes sense. What are your thoughts on new supply? I mean, we've talked about demand and the demand continuing to increase in the housing market and in other real estate asset classes. That, you know, multifamily starts are down 70% from their peak in 2022. You mentioned the same thing with office, where right now we're seeing a bunch of supply coming online because all this construction started pre-COVID and during COVID when debt was cheap and made sense to build. Now all of that, all those the permitting and construction starts has come down. So to me, I'm looking down into 2026 and 27, where there's just going to be this drought of new supply right as demand is really accelerating. Do you see those same dynamics?
Yep. And that's what creates a cycle, right?
Yeah.
You know, the Absolutely. Little, you know, so yeah. So office, you know, I would expect would bottom in 2025, 2026. Industrial's gone into a little bit of oversupply because of the frenzy of, and I'll tell a fun story here. So online sales went from 8 to 9 to 10 to 11 to 12%, right? COVID hits and it jumps to 18 and Amazon goes, oh my God, we just got a 50% increase in demand. So they started signing leases and getting properties built for them, et cetera. COVID's finally over, you know, within a year, and online sales bounce back down to their original trajectory and they're at 12.5 going to 13. And so Amazon walks away from some leases and things like that. And everybody goes, oh my God, terrible, terrible, right? But a lot of other people that couldn't lease property because Amazon was, what, in 2019, Amazon leased 25% of all space leased in the country.
Oh my God.
And so other people needed it. And because that demand was so high, we took rental rates and like doubled them, right? We were at $6 a square foot and went to 10 or 11. And now that's come down a little bit, but you know, the demand's still there. There's more people. We're buying more stuff. We're still, you know, things are happening. One of the cool things there is that all of the new electric cars that are being built, they need battery. They need batteries and all kind of stuff. That there's like, can't remember the number, 40 million square feet of warehouse space needed just to help in the manufacturing of all that stuff. In the U.S. alone, right? So that's huge, right? Again, retail, people are back in spending. Spending has slowed a little bit, but, you know, the right type of retail is doing unbelievably well. And again, that's where people think they can go out and do them themselves. You've got to have a real estate expert who knows what's going on in the marketplace to understand it, right?
Yep.
And that's really key. And then hotel, again, there are some hotel, like there's some San Francisco hotels that are closing because business people aren't going there, right? But there's other, you know, resort hotels in California that are just killing it.
Right.
You have over 40 years of experience analyzing real estate trends, economics. What are your go-to sources today? Like, what do you look at every day to kind of collect the information to stay in tune with the economy and the market?
Sure. With the publicly traded REITs, NAREIT has a daily email that comes out. And the thing that I like is it just, you know, it'll highlight, you know, and give you two sentences on the key things that were happening. So I get six of those. I can read that in about a minute and a half. And then if I want depth, I go right in and look at that. The major brokerage firms, Coldwell Banker, CBRE, and Jones Lang LaSalle, JLL, they put out either daily or weekly, you know, emails that are, you know, are free because they're trying to get your business. I work in the institutional world. So the Pension Real Estate Association has a daily email with stuff about what institutions are doing, which kind of, you know, they're obviously highly educated and kind of know what's going on. So those trends as well. So any of the major national associations have these NIOP for office and industrial. There's all good things to watch. I don't deal with the home ownership side of the world at all. So I don't do anything there. But if you wanted to, you could probably get the National Association of Realtors.
Fantastic. Those are great resources. Well, with that, we want to be respectful of your time. Dr. Miller, thank you so much. Hopefully we can, I don't know, maybe we can get you to, we can convince you to come to our conference and do a keynote, but we'll talk about that later. Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah. Actually, I think it was well over a decade ago. I did one for you guys way back when.
That was for the Best Ever Conference. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I saw you there. It was fantastic. So it's an honor to interview you today.
And I hope that wasn't a decade ago. Jeez, that's been a long time.
How can people find out more about you? Do you have any other resources that you'd like to share with people or connect, on LinkedIn or something like that? How can people find out more about you or buy your textbook?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn. My textbook is, you can get it on Amazon, Educated Reinvesting. My market cycle reports are available from University of Denver, du.edu/Burns, B-U-R-N-S, Burns School. And all my historic ones for the last, 8 years or so are there.
Fantastic.
To look at. And then one short plug, I am also now on the board of a charity called Sharing Connection, and that's with an X. That's located in Denver, and we help with affordable housing. We help developers get things done. Anytime you build affordable housing, getting the permit loan, government's going to take care of that, no problem. Getting the construction loan, the development loan is the hard part. And so we're raising a $20 million fund to do that, where people, the idea is lend us money at a low interest rate with a high impact, where you're going to help. Because right now, when interest rates went up, all of a sudden, the development side of affordable housing became, not financially feasible anymore.
It's a great idea. That's
so we're
fantastic.
Trying to offer loans to affordable housing developers at basically, the 10-year treasury rate or that type of thing. So much lower than they could get from a bank, so that they can actually get their project done. Yeah. So that's what's taking up my time.
Fantastic.
Awesome. And busy.
Glenn Miller, thank you so much for gracing us with your presence. We hope to see you again sometime soon. Thank you for coming on.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care.